From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An historic nuclear deal struck early today in Vienna. Iran agrees to an international clampdown on its nuclear activities and comes in from the cold of diplomatic isolation and sanctions. But is the deal as good, as solid, as enforceable as the smiling diplomats in Vienna say it is? This hour on Point, judging the nuclear deal with Iran. You can join us on air or online. Do you trust this deal with Iran? Are you delighted at this diplomatic breakthrough or worried? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You'll also find the text of the Iran nuclear deal there as well. We're going to go to Vienna in a moment, but first, joining me from the Iranian capital is Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief for The New York Times. Thomas, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi.
I know you have to run to a meeting in a few minutes, so let's get you in here. Tell us the response in Tehran today to this historic deal.
Well, I mean, you would be expecting that people would go out on the streets to celebrate the fact that, you know, decades of sanctions have been or are in the process of being lifted. But they haven't yet, and that, of course, has to do with the fact that, this is the holy month of fasting, the month of Ramadan. So a lot of people are expecting to go out later today. And, of course, they're celebrating because they feel that this will give them a new start. Well, at the same time, there are also already people who are saying this might not be a good deal. These are, of course, the hardliners that we hear so much about here in Iran. These are people who oppose a deal. They say that this deal might bring Iran and the West closer, and it will undermine Iran's revolutionary principles. They are saying that certain parts about inspection, certain parts about the sanctions of this deal are not the way Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei wanted it, and they are saying red lines have been crossed. Undoubtedly, in the coming days and weeks, we will hear a lot from this group who will strongly oppose this deal.
So, hardliners aside, this morning, Iranian Foreign Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mohammad Zarif, said that this deal is an achievement.
I believe this is a historic moment. We are reaching an agreement that is not perfect for anybody, but it is what we could accomplish, and it is an important achievement for all of us. Today could have been the end of hope on this issue, but now we are starting a new chapter of hope.
With the end of sanctions there in Iran, presumably upcoming, what do the average Iranians think this deal means for them?
Well, it means that they will be able to, again, restart their small businesses, that they will be able to send money abroad, they will be able to engage in the world economy instead of only here in Iran, because under these sanctions, they're not able to transfer money to other countries. They're not able to get international letters of credit. So for normal average Iranians, it means an opening up to the world, something they very much want, because a lot of them are basically the same middle-class people that you would have in Europe or the United States who don't want extremism, but a better life for their children. Mm.
You talked about this being the month of Ramadan, relatively quiet there today, although you could still hear chants of death to America in Iran as recently as last week. Is it, to your mind, is this simply economic relief with no real commitment to working with America moving forward?
Well, the country is divided along those lines. And again, I want to mention the hardliners. They feel that Iran should not use this nuclear accord as a kind of a step towards engaging further with the United States. They say we should only engage with the United States on a case-by-case basis. But those people I was just talking about, those average middle-class Iranians, yeah, of course they want to have relations with the United States. They have family members living there. They want to go there and visit. They like to wear Nike clothes, just like anywhere else in the world. So they are giving a lot of pushback to these hardliners, and we'll see this tug of war playing out over the coming months. It's not only the deal, but also this prospect of increasing relations with the great Satan, as America here is officially known, will proceed. Mm.
Thomas Erdbrink is the Tehran bureau chief for The New York Times. He spoke with me from Tehran. Thomas, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Joining me now from Vienna is Jay Solomon of the Wall Street Journal. He covers foreign affairs and national security for the Journal and has spent the last 18 days in Vienna covering the negotiations. Jay Solomon, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
So I had this agreement in front of me here, about an inch thick. The first page, the preface, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. In the first paragraph, it says, Iran reaffirms that under no circumstances will Iran ever seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons. There's a lot to this agreement. Help us understand the details here.
I mean, basically, the critics will say they're not dismantling the program. But the Obama administration basically created a formula where they said they have a one-year breakout. They put so many restrictions on Iran's program that it would take essentially a year for them to build enough material, a nuclear material for a weapon, because of all these restrictions. And the agreement really outlines all the steps. They've significantly reduced the number of centrifuge machines they have to produce nuclear fuel. They've reduced their stockpile of nuclear fuel. They're committing to repurposing a reactor so it can't produce weapons-grade plutonium. And they've opened themselves up to more inspections by UN monitors. So basically, it's a guarantee for a decade. Or the White House will argue it's a guarantee for a decade that that the Iranians couldn't move to build a nuclear weapon without the U.S. knowing about it.
Addressing the Iran nuclear agreement at the White House earlier today, President Obama here explains key components of the deal.
Because of this deal, Iran will not produce the highly enriched uranium and weapons-grade plutonium that form the raw materials necessary for a nuclear bomb. Because of this deal, Iran will remove two-thirds of its installed centrifuges, the machines necessary to produce highly enriched uranium for a bomb, and store them under constant international supervision. Iran will not use its advanced centrifuges to produce enriched uranium for the next decade. Iran will also get rid of 98% of its stockpile of enriched uranium.
So, Jay Solomon, Iran will remove two-thirds of its installed centrifuges. As you say, gets rid of 98% of its stockpile of enriched uranium. Inspectors have 24/7 access to Iran's nuclear facilities. I mean, the question comes here, can Iran hide a facility from the U.S. at this point?
Well, I think there are a couple of questions. One of the criticisms is that Iran is maintaining a large part of its nuclear infrastructure, and many of these restrictions are only in place for 10 or 15 years. So I think the worry is that they could basically abide by this program, but continue to do certain types of nuclear research, maintain these centrifuges, and then after 10 or 15 years, kind of overtly almost move towards developing a nuclear weapon. That's the real concern. I think the White House is making a bet in some ways that during that time, you might have political change in Iran. The supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, is 75 and hasn't been in great health. And it could be a very different country in the 10 to 15 years that these restrictions are put in place. But there are, like you said, there's a lot more monitors being put in place. The one fear is that they're going to have trouble getting into some of these military installations that are still a concern that they might have been used in a secret weapons program.
So those are the headlines of the deal. What about the sanctions relief for Iran? What does the agreement say about that?
Well, once Iran starts taking these steps to restrain its nuclear program, that will probably happen in 2 to 3 months, and it kind of depends a bit on what happens in the UN, in the Congress, then there's a pretty dramatic repeal of the sanctions that the U.S., the European Union, and the United Nations have put in place over the last 10 years. The most dramatic will be, in a lot of ways, the repeal of a EU embargo on oil purchases. You can see a lot more Iranian oil going into the market, which is why you see oil prices falling today. And Iran's going to be back into the international banking system in a lot of ways. They were totally cut off when they were kicked off a system called the SWIFT network, which basically guides interbank transactions. So once they start taking these steps to restrain the nuclear program, the sanctions will be lifted pretty quickly. Mm.
This deal culminated after 18 straight days. You've been there. You've seen it all, the rocky negotiations that stretched through the night. We read about occasional shouting matches in these closed-door negotiations. Give us a brief summary of what it took to get everybody to the table in Vienna to this point.
Well, they did agree on sort of a comprehensive framework in early April, so that the parameters of the deal were known. What was hard was kind of nailing it down, getting all the legalities down. And what was still kind of always an X factor was where the supreme leader of Iran really stood. He gave a speech in June where he seemed to backtrack on some of these commitments. The U.S. didn't always know, you know, where the supreme leader was, but there were heated exchanges, particularly last week. One issue that the Americans thought in a lot of ways had been kind of dealt with was Iran's demand that an arms embargo placed on it by the UN and limitations on its ballistic missile program be lifted. And that was kind of the most contentious issue over the past week and led to these all-night debates. I don't think they really got this thing done until the early hours of the morning. Mm.
Jay Solomon covers foreign affairs and national security for The Wall Street Journal. He joined me from Vienna. Jay, thank you. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the nuclear deal with Iran, trying to figure out whether the Obama administration has achieved a huge diplomatic breakthrough or made a historic mistake, as many critics fear. You can join the conversation. How do you see this unfolding? Do you think it changes the balance of power in the Middle East? Do you welcome or fear that? Earlier today, Secretary of State John Kerry said that this is the deal that the U.S. has been looking for with Iran.
This is the good deal that we have sought. Believe me, had we been willing to settle for a lesser deal, we would have finished this negotiation a long time ago. But we were not. All of us, not just the United States, but France, the United Kingdom, Germany, Russia, China, and the EU, were determined to get this right. And so we have been patient, and I believe our persistence has paid off.
As the nuclear Iran deal goes to Congress now for consideration, President Obama, speaking at the White House earlier today, said that a world without this deal has to be considered.
As the American people and Congress review the deal, it will be important to consider the alternative. Consider what happens in a world without this deal. Without this deal, there is no scenario where the world joins us in sanctioning Iran until it completely dismantles its nuclear program.
Joining me now from Las Vegas is Michael Singh, Senior Fellow and Managing Director at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, former Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council from 2005 to 2008. He has cast a fairly skeptical eye on the long unfolding nuclear negotiations with Iran. Michael, so great to have you.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And from Harwich, Massachusetts, we're joined by Robert Einhorn. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and was a member of the Obama administration's Iran negotiating team until he left the State Department in June 2013. He takes a more positive view of the Obama administration's efforts. Robert, great to have you as well.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
I'll start with you, Robert. Your initial reaction to this seemingly historic deal with Iran.
Well, you know, the first thing to say, Jane, is it's a very complicated technical deal, over 100 pages. We've only recently, just today, received the document. I've scanned it, haven't read it through. I think it's important for everyone to take the time to digest the deal and understand it properly. At this time, I think our reactions can only be preliminary. Certainly mine are preliminary. It's important to understand that no negotiated deal is going to be perfect. But this one, as far as I can tell, seems to meet the administration's stated requirements. In particular, it seems to be an effective way of blocking Iran's path to nuclear weapons for at least 10 to 15 years and perhaps longer. And it gives us enhanced means of monitoring Iran's behavior, its nuclear activities, so that any effort to violate the agreement and break out and achieve nuclear weapons should be detected at a very early stage and give us time to react and to stop any attempt by Iran to get nuclear weapons.
Indeed, the devil is in the details, Michael Singh. Your early reaction to this deal announced today?
Well, I agree with Bob that it's a long and complicated deal, and I do think that it deserves scrutiny. It deserves everyone at least taking the chance to read it and try to work through those details, those of us who are experts and analysts. I will say that, look, my initial impression upon having read through the deal is that it is not quite that good deal that we had hoped for, as Secretary Kerry said. In fact, I think it is a deal with very significant weaknesses. When you kind of get through the discussion of what the limitations will be, you realize that, number one, it is a far cry from what the United States had hoped to achieve. Unlike, say, the Libya deal last decade, nothing is really dismantled. There are no commitments that Iran makes on its other troubling policies, like its support for terrorism or regional policies. In fact, the restrictions which are placed on Iran are, in just about every case, temporary, and it sort of leaves us with a question as to what happens in the 8 to 10 to 15 years when those restrictions go away. And yet it does provide Iran with very comprehensive lifting of sanctions, including on its arms trafficking and its ballistic missile activities, on which it makes no commitments in the deal itself. And so there's an asymmetry there. So I think you're going to see a lot of criticism of this. And then I think the deal depends highly on inspections and verification measures, and those measures have some very key weaknesses, which I think will also be problematic in the domestic debate here.
Michael Singh, speak to that first point. Jay Solomon brought this up. You know, it seems in the next decade we'll be right back at the negotiating table again. Do Iranians see that as working in their favor?
Well, this is one of, I think, the key worries that you're going to encounter about this deal, especially amongst folks in the region itself, Iran's neighbors. Because some of the restrictions on Iran expire in as early as 5 years. That would be, for example, the arms embargo on Iran. Others expire in 8 years, like the restrictions on Iran's ballistic missile activities, as well as the restrictions on its centrifuge R&D activities. And then others are phased out in 10 to 15 years. The new UN Security Council resolution will expire in 10 years. So really, after that period, after that 5 to 15-year period, there will be effectively no special limitations on Iran's nuclear activities, no remaining sanctions really on Iran with regard to its nuclear program, except the restrictions found in the Non-Proliferation Treaty itself. Mm-hmm. And so I think those states are going to have to look at those years as potentially the years where they have to deal with a much more capable Iran, and I think that will be destabilizing for the region.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, needless to say, said this agreement is a historic mistake. Here he is before the official announcement today, speaking in Jerusalem, saying that the deal is not good.
Our concern, of course, is that the militant Islamic State of Iran is going to receive a sure path to nuclear weapons. Many of the restrictions that were supposed to prevent it from getting there will be lifted. And in addition, Iran will get a jackpot of cash bonanza of hundreds of billions of dollars, which will enable it to continue to pursue its aggression and terror in the region and in the world. This is a bad mistake.
A jackpot, a cash bonanza, Bob Einhorn, of hundreds of billions of dollars. What do you make of Israel's pushback on this? Israel says it will deploy all diplomatic means to prevent the confirmation of this agreement. Will the White House be able to counter his influence?
Well, it's interesting to recall that the day that the parties reached agreement in November of 2013 on an interim deal, Prime Minister Netanyahu called this a historic mistake, and he criticized it in all kinds of ways. Sanctions would erode. Iran's nuclear program would not really be frozen. Well, within a year, the Israelis had come to the conclusion that this interim deal was a pretty good deal, and they were happy for it to continue for some period of time. So today's statement by Prime Minister Netanyahu came not after the deal was released, but before it. He didn't have the benefit of having even read the deal or getting briefed on it. So I think one has to, take his premature criticism with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. I think over time, hopefully, the Israelis will develop a more balanced view of this measure. In terms of his ability to persuade the Congress to reject it, well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. I think the opponents have an uphill battle to try to reject the agreement. They'll need a two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress in order to do that, in order to override an expected presidential veto. And I doubt they have that two-thirds
majority. We'll get to the political aspect of this in a moment. A lot of response from listeners here. Let's get a couple in. Marion in Southern Pines, North Carolina. Hi, Marion. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Well, I'm just calling to say I want to offer a deep bow of gratitude for the exhausting work, the diplomacy, the courage of all who participated in negotiating this historic deal. I do think it's a historic breakthrough. It's very welcome, and I do extend my hand across the world to the people of Iran in friendship. I'm a 50-year voting Democrat. I've been supporting candidates who work for peace all this time. And I just could not be happier. And I'm not really bothered by, if you hear someone say, well, in Iran, there are people who say death to America. Well, I reflect upon the tragedy, the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are people here who, have hatred.
But I hear you saying you support this one. Marion, thank you very much. Let's go to Dave in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Dave. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I keep hearing the phrase historic deal, and I don't doubt that it is so, particularly in this era of sound bites. I guess I would like your guest to speak to the idea of what some cynics might say, that we're in an era of just, diplomacy and deals for deal's sake. If you really look at the nuts and bolts of the deal, as your guests have been expounding upon, then there's really no there. It's not really a quote-unquote game changer. I think what it does is that it allows both sides, after a long and arduous ordeal, to come to the table and say, hey, we've reached an agreement. What does that mean? Well, it means that for the public consumption of the media, the public consumers of the media, who are perhaps not as learned as some, the soundbite is excellent.
Dave, straight, thank you. Let's put that to Michael Singh quickly before we go to Washington. And Michael Singh, there are quite specific details involved here, which we've gone over. Two-thirds of the installed centrifuges removed, stockpile, 98% of the Iranian stockpile of enriched uranium gone, 24/7 access. But what do you say to Dave's response? This is a deal for deal's sake.
Well, look, I think, in response to what the first caller said, I agree. This involved a lot of effort, and I hope that the debate will not sort of descend into ad hominem attacks, certainly from either side. When you look at the nuts and bolts, I do think that we should have an examination of, is this a good enough deal? The big problems here are not so much that, the number of centrifuges and so forth, but it leaves in Iran's hand that nuclear weapons option, which it could potentially exercise in the future, and only imposes temporary limitations. And because it's not requiring Iran to dismantle its nuclear infrastructure, it depends so heavily on verification that yet when you look at the inspections and verification, you see there isn't the anytime, anywhere inspections that we had hoped for. In fact, it's a laborious process for the IAEA to get to where it needs. The question of PMD, Iran's past weaponization work, is really not addressed in a significant way in the agreement. It's sort of compartmented off to the side where the IAEA will pursue it separately, and nothing in the deal really depends on Iran giving the answers that it has long denied to the IAEA. And so I think these are, again, the issues which critics will find troubling, and I hope that we can have an honest discussion of those things without the sort of the ad hominem attacks that we've seen.
Robert and Michael, hold on for a moment. I want to bring Phil Ewing into the conversation now. He's senior defense reporter for Politico. He's been watching the nuclear talks and the reaction on Capitol Hill. He joins me from Washington. Phil, welcome. Good to have you.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
So this deal faces political headwinds in Congress, to say the least. Criticism crosses party lines. Tell us about this. Congress now has 60 days to approve or reject the deal?
Yeah, that's correct. This clock starts technically when Congress receives a formal notice from the White House that this agreement has been concluded, and then it has that time to hold hearings, get briefings from the administration, have debates in the House and Senate, and then for lawmakers to decide how they'd like to respond. Congress doesn't have to do anything. It can pass resolutions in both houses, which it would then send to the president, either endorsing or opposing this deal. But as we heard on your program earlier, Obama came out this morning and said he would veto any legislation from Congress that would stop it from going forward. And so the way it looks today, Obama ultimately will get this agreement, because if he vetoes a bill and sends it back to Congress, right now it would be very, very difficult for members to overcome that veto, you know, given the rules of this agreement.
Mm. Earlier today, House Speaker John Boehner, Republican from Ohio, called this deal, quote, unacceptable, saying he will do everything he can to stop it.
He's going to hand a dangerous regime billions of dollars in sanctions relief while paving the way for a nuclear Iran.
So talk a little bit more about that then, Phil. If Congress sends this back to the president, then what happens? What if they don't sign off on it? What next?
Then it would go forward. Republicans and Democrats, especially in the Senate, would have to come together in a two-thirds majority to overturn a veto by the president, which looks very unlikely. It would mean it would be very likely, I should say, that the White House could find enough votes to continue to support the deal. And so from the way it appears today, either Congress acting before a veto or after a veto, the president will get this agreement, at least as it stands. Of course, anything can happen. Different realizations could become public between now and then. And, you know, it's a foolish game to try to predict the future definitively, especially when it comes to politics. But that's the way the tea leaves appear, at least as of today.
A lot of Republicans tweeting out there today. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas tweeting this morning, they, meaning Iran, have blood of hundreds of American soldiers on their hands and were giving sanctions relief. Republican Ben Sasse of Nebraska saying the administration just lit the fuse for a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. We all know Iran's neighbors will not sit idly as the world's largest state sponsor of terror becomes a nuclear threshold state, end quote. President Obama made it very clear, Phil Ewing, today that he would fight to preserve this deal in its entirety. He said, I will veto any legislation that prevents the successful implementation of this deal. How successful do you think this morning he was in moving this conversation in his direction?
I think he's moved the conversation in his direction for a long time. He's been he and his administration have been working on behalf of these negotiations for months and years, as we've heard your other guests talk about. And I think, at least from the White House perspective, they've set the table very successfully for this process. The White House likes to release news coverage which describes poll findings which show, according to them, a majority of Americans support a diplomatic track. They support resolving the nuclear issue with Iran diplomatically through these negotiations, through this process, as opposed to through a conflict. It's a little bit of a false equivalency. The way the situation is often presented politically in Washington is either we do a deal or World War III breaks out in the Middle East, although it probably would not be that clear cut. But still, that is one thing that comes up. Well, if you don't want this deal, that means you must want us to attack these nuclear facilities, which would spark a regional conflict and not be good for anyone. And so far, the president has evidently been persuasive for a lot of people.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We and much of the world are trying to figure out what this new deal with Iran on its nuclear program and more means for the region, for the world today. You can join the conversation. Will Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama go down in history as great diplomats or great appeasers? My guest this hour, Michael Singh of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Robert Einhorn of the Brookings Institution, and Phil Ewing, who writes for Politico. Here's some more sound at the conclusion of his address at the White House this morning. President Obama said this deal is a sign that working together leads to success.
History shows that America must lead not just with our might, but with our principles. It shows we are stronger not when we are alone, but when we bring the world together.
In an interview with CNN earlier today, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said President Obama will face strong pushback surrounding the nuclear deal with Iran.
Mr. President, you want a robust debate? You're going to get one. You've been dangerously naive about the Mideast. You and John Kerry have. You've allowed the region to go into flames. The radical Islam on the Sunni side is running wild. Now you're giving the largest state sponsor in terrorism an infusion of cash, a large nuclear program that over time will turn into a bomb.
Let's get more calls in here. Shalom is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Shalom. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hey.
I have 2 points,
okay,
which I would appreciate your panel clarifying.
Yeah.
The first one, very, very important, is verification. And the question I have, do we have assurance that any place, any time, without any notice, can be accessed by the team of verifiers? No delay in time, which would, of course, enable them to clear up the place. No delay and no exclusion of any place.
Got it. And the second point?
The second point is what President Obama touched, but we didn't hear what the other side had to say. Namely, the United States, our flag has been trampled upon or burned just a few days ago. The United States is no more the big Satan. Israel is not the little Satan. And they do not intend to nuke either of those countries. That Israel has right to exist. And the United States, which can be reached by 6,000-mile missiles, is not any more to be destroyed. No death to America. Has that been clarified and reported, not just in the hopeful, very nice expression by our president?
Right, but much deeper. Shalom, thank you. I've got it. Let me play this clip before I ask our guest to respond. Speaking at the White House earlier today, President Obama said Iran will be expected to adhere to the conditions of the nuclear deal.
Because of this deal, we will, for the first time, be in a position to verify all of these commitments. That means this deal is not built on trust. It is built on verification. Inspectors will have 24/7 access to Iran's key nuclear facilities.
24/7, any place, any time, verification. Bob Einhorn, what do you say?
Well, any place, yes. There was a concern that Iran may simply declare military installations to be out of bounds for inspectors. The U.S. and its partners succeeded in getting Iran to agree that any place was eligible for inspection. Now, there's a procedure that has been developed, a number of steps. Iran, if it denies access to inspectors, the IAEA can go to a joint commission, and there Iran can be outvoted by a majority. Even with Russia and China supporting Iran, they can be outvoted. The Iranians can be required to permit access, and if Iran continues to deny access, this can be taken immediately to the Security Council, and the Security Council will automatically reimpose sanctions. Hmm. So there's a dispute resolution mechanism that's quite advantageous. And if Iran attempts to block access, then appeal can be made to the Security Council and sanctions could be reimposed. Hmm.
Speaking with CNN earlier today, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina again said that the nuclear deal with Iran will lead to bigger problems broadly in the Middle East.
This is a change in the Mideast that I've been fearing for all of my life. We have now set the Mideast on a course that, if we don't change course, is going to lead to a nuclear-armed Mideast.
And nearing the end of his address today, President Obama said the work in this region, broadly again, is not over.
We will continue the work we began at Camp David to elevate our partnership with the Gulf states to strengthen their capabilities to counter threats from Iran or terrorist groups like ISIL. However, I believe that we must continue to test whether or not this region, which has known so much suffering, so much bloodshed, can move in a different direction.
Michael Singh, broaden this out for us beyond Iran into the broader Middle East. What about Saudi Arabia? What about Jordan? What are the reactions in the Middle East, to this deal?
Well, I think you'll see one sort of reaction in public and then maybe a different calculation in private. In public, I think you'll hear mixed reactions from our allies in the region. We've already heard from Israel, obviously a very negative reaction. You've seen the Syrian president, not an ally of the United States, certainly congratulate Iran, but so has the leader of the United Arab Emirates, certainly an ally of the United States. I think that, you know, for those countries which are allied with the United States, they'll be troubled, I think, by, again, the temporary nature of the agreements. I think they'll be troubled by the amount of funds that Iran will be receiving, because, remember, they worry more, really, about Iran's destabilizing regional activities, its support for Hezbollah and Hamas, the Taliban, its activities in Syria and Iraq. And they worry that Iran will have now not just more money to do those things, but fewer impediments in the form of sanctions against doing those things. And, of course, I think they will look at the United States' determination to counter Iran in the region with a skeptical eye because of some of this talk about the transformation of U.S.-Iran relations. And so it really now will fall to U.S. policymakers in this administration and the next to demonstrate what the president says, that we're still determined to fight Iranian sponsorship of terrorism and other troublesome policies.
Bob Einhorn, in Tehran, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani posted a message on Twitter saying that this deal shows that constructive engagement works. With this unnecessary crisis resolved, new horizons emerge with focus on shared challenges, end quote. I'm just curious, Iran had outlined some very tough red lines throughout this process. How does it look to the Iranians, especially the hardliners, but broadly to the people of Iran, that there was such significant shift in their red line stances?
Well, it's true. Many of the supreme leaders' red lines were crossed, but I think the propaganda apparatus of the Iranian regime is capable enough to explain to the Iranian public why that was necessary, or they may even make the case that the red lines were not crossed. But it's clear that the negotiators in Vienna have succeeded on a deal that really is inconsistent with many of the leaders' red lines. And, you know, it'll be up to the Iranian regime to explain that to the Iranian public. And I'm sure Iranian hardliners will heavily criticize the deal for those reasons.
And Michael Singh, if this deal is rejected by Congress, as so many are promising, what about our relationship with Iran moving forward? And frankly, our relationship with other partners in the deal, like Russia and China?
Well, you know, I think the scenario you outlined, disapproval by Congress, is probably not a very likely one, given the 67-vote threshold in the Senate, the two-thirds majority you would need to override the president's veto. I think, though, that regardless of whether it's approved or disapproved by Congress, I frankly don't anticipate that this will be transformative when it comes to U.S.-Iran relations. There's certainly nothing in the agreement which requires any change in behavior from Iran, and there's nothing really in Iranian behavior in the last, say, couple of years, in the last months, or in Iran's statements to suggest that they are planning to change their behavior. And we have to remember, when we listen to Iranian officials, that there's a debate within Iran on this. And the Iranian officials who we see as most pragmatic, who are involved in this negotiation, like President Rouhani, Foreign Minister Zarif, are not the ones who control the levers of Iranian power in places like Syria and Iraq and Lebanon and so forth. And so I think we have to brace ourselves for at least a continuation of those difficult ties and maybe even a spike in Iranian misbehavior.
Phil Ewing, do you agree with Michael? What about the 67-vote threshold in Congress? Unlikely?
I think it is unlikely. I think the president can convince enough members, both in his own party and some borderline Republicans who have said they will examine this deal on its merits and take the president's suggestion this morning that we should imagine a world without the deal or imagine the alternatives to be able to protect it if we get to that point. It's also possible that individual members will continue to criticize the president and this deal, likely in perpetuity, and that Congress will take no action because it would be potentially better if they decide to make this calculation to not act and not hand the president another victory by vetoing the deal and then having him get it after all when Congress isn't able to overturn that veto. Congress never acted on President Obama's request to authorize the military operations against the Islamic State in large measure because members calculated that they did not want to own that operation and that it was better to just kind of let it fall by the wayside. And so they never did. And we may come to that point as well, depending, again, on how this all plays out going forward.
Let's go to John in Houghton, Michigan. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm interested to think that in the backstory of this whole thing is Iran as a potential partner, although it be a strange bedfellow, in our effort against ISIS. So is there some motive to craft a deal and to build, you know, some level of partnership with Iran by easing the sanctions and showing that we can collaborate and maybe taking some of the pressure off? In the back room of this is an agreement to say we really do need support and Iran to be a strong resistor of ISIL expansion in the region and that might be the motivator to say we really do need an agreement because otherwise we've got unfettered expansion of ISIS and and radicalization while they're supporting Syria and Hezbollah. The greater evil right now is an ISIL expansion and embroilment of the entire region.
That's really an interesting point, John. Thank you very much. Robert Einhorn, respond, please.
Clearly, the U.S. and Iran have some common interests in the region, especially defeating ISIS. But we cannot count on this agreement moderating Iran's behavior. I completely agree with Michael Singh. That it's likely that Iran will continue its efforts to destabilize the region through its proxies. So I think accompanying this deal, which doesn't deal with the regional aspect, accompanying the deal, the president and his administration need to adopt a very strong, resolute regional strategy aimed at strengthening our friends in the region, like the Israelis, like the Saudis, as well as reassuring them that we're going to counter future attempts by Iran to destabilize the region.
Here's Salim from Montreal, Canada. Salim, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
I just add a different voice to the conversation.
Please.
I'm Jewish. I was born in Iran. I lived through the revolution. I intimately understand the horrors when the revolution was hijacked by the clerics in 1979. I'm as committed as can be to the survival of the State of Israel, and I will tell you that I'm fully in support of this process and this agreement. And the reason being is the alternative would strengthen the hardliners in Iran, and nothing's going to change Iran other than its people. The people are, you know, if the moderates and the progressive people in Iran are strengthened by this process, they are only the ones who are going to be able to change Iran's path back to where it should be. Mm. And so from that perspective, I believe this is a very positive step forward.
Thank you, Salim, very much. One last call from Charlie in Millis, Massachusetts. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just thought I'd like to add to the conversation. It seems that our elected representatives on both sides of the aisle don't consider it a good deal unless we get everything we want and Iran gets nothing they want. It's a two-way street. That's what negotiation is all about.
Indeed, Charlie. Thanks for adding that at the end here. Michael Singh, what do you see the path forward being now? I mean, we've got Congress looking at this, have 60 days to do so, and then what?
Well, you know, to the two points that were just made, I think that the you've heard the president sort of describe the choice in cosmic terms, you know, between diplomacy and war. I do think it's not the right framing of the issue. I think that it's not as though those who think this is a flawed deal are rejecting diplomacy. I think the question will be, did we really get what we need to get? Could we have gotten more, and could we still get more? Did we sort of squander the leverage that we had so studiously built up? And that, I think, is what is going to characterize the debate going forward. That debate will take us into mid-September. The actual adoption of the agreement may not take place for some time after that if you look at the implementation plan. So the initial steps will take us well, I think, into 2016. And so folks should understand this is the beginning, really, of a process. It's the beginning of a process of debate and deliberation here in the United States, in Iran, in other capitals. And then we'll have to see if this agreement can stand the test of implementation and the test of time, which, frankly, the previous agreements which we reached with Iran in 2003 and 2004 did not. They were very short-lived because of disagreements over implementation. And so it's the beginning of what will, I think, be yet again a long saga.
Thank you very much. A terrific panel today. Michael Singh, Senior Fellow and Managing Director at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Michael, it's great to have you.
Thank you.
Robert Einhorn, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much, Bob.
Thank you, Jane.
And Phil Ewing covers defense for Politico. Phil, great to have you on as well.
My pleasure, Jane. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks to you, listeners. This is On Point.